and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Ben Rylan. On today's show, we're staying in and going out, hitting the shops and getting some artistic food for thought. Well, I'll be joined in the studio by Toby Earle, TV editor for London Live, and Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International New York Times, to find out what we should and shouldn't be watching on the television and on the stage this week. Plus, we'll nip over to Amsterdam to peruse the shelves of its only Arabic bookshop. And we'll meet the duo trying to demystify the confusing world of contemporary art. And of course, we'll have a look at our global countdown, which this week takes us all the way to South America. That's all to come on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Well, without further ado, Toby and Matt, hello and welcome to the program to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Matt, we'll be getting your theatre picks a little later in the program, but first I think we need to turn to the small screen, starting off now with Top of the Lake, which is the BBC's crime drama starring Elizabeth Moss as Detective Robin Griffin. Toby, tell us what the story is so far and perhaps where the second series is going to pick up. I was quite a fan of the first series.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of controversy there with the casting of Elizabeth Moss because, if I remember correctly, it was originally meant to be a co-production with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which
right.
They weren't very happy with having an American cast instead of an Australian. But nevertheless, the second series will be featuring quite a high-profile Australian.
Well, yeah, I mean, just to recap briefly, Top of the Lake, Jane Campion's murder mystery drama, which was in the first series, set in New Zealand. And it used, of course, the stunning Lord of the Rings vistas to tell this story of a missing girl from a local community and Robin Griffin, this detective played by Elizabeth Moss, going over there to find out exactly what has taken place. And it was lyrical, elegiac. It had Holly Hunter as this sort of leader of a commune, and it had this sort of really slow pace to it, and you kind of got a sense of the wilderness, you know, and this detective Robin Griffin, this cosmopolitan individual, sort of placed in a world which she is sort of unfamiliar with. And over the course of the series, some rather radical events take place, and you're left with quite a sour taste in your mouth because of what is exposed. Now, what I think is so great about Top of the Lake, China Girl, to give it its full title, Top of the Lake, China Girl, I forgot the punctuation mark, and that should never be done. This actually relocates Moss back to Sydney, so she's now back. It's a few years on from the events of Top of the Lake.
So in the first series, she originally grew up in New Zealand, I think, her character, and then had moved to Sydney and then had come back home again.
Exactly. But she was still very much, she was this kind of strange beast to the local population, because even though she knew the area and they knew her and she'd grown up with these people, she had moved to the big city.
And she had lost her New Zealand accent.
She
which happens to a lot of New Zealanders, actually, when they go to Australia.
Yeah, she was an Aussie, you know, she was an Aussie, which she obviously immediately probably gets their sort of hackles up even higher than it already would having an outsider coming in. She's Australian as well. So yeah, so now she's back in Sydney. But again, it continues the themes of loneliness and of exclusion by its subject matter. Now, what takes place on Top of the Lake in the first series stays with Robin Griffin in the second. In fact, very early in the series, you have a call back to it, and it's big colleagues in the police department call back to what took place in the first series. I don't want to spoil it because it really, really should be watched. But these themes of exclusion and loneliness are then mirrored by the storyline, which involves human trafficking, prostitution, and sex slavery, and the murder of a young woman whose body is then dumped in a suitcase in the ocean, and it eventually washes to shore. Now, it played at Can. It was very warmly received. I've seen the first 2 hours. It's what they showed at Cannes. It was a 2-hour film, and it still possesses that pace. It still possesses that sort of haunting quality, particularly embodied through Moss. So I think he's a terrific actress. I mean, she came over, I spoke to her about this, and she loves what's happened in the second series, how the character's changed and over the kind of course of these few years. She herself has changed. So the character's sort of moved along with her. It's worth noting as well that in this series you have Gwendolyn Christie, who most people recognise as Brienne of Tarth from Game of Thrones, and also Nicole Kidman, who plays the adoptive mother of Robin Griffin's own child, who she gave up for adoption when she was very young. It's a powerhouse cast.
Absolutely.
Really, of three brilliant actresses. And I think particularly with Elizabeth Moss, I think she is one of the prime acting talents currently at work, both, I'm sure, Matt, you would say as well, on stage, yeah, as well as...
She's great on stage.
Incredible, right? And I think what she has that ability to command both, you know, all these spaces, be it screen, be it TV or stage. And there is, in best possible way, I mean, there's a theatrical quality to her performance in this. There's depth, there is weight, and you feel alone. I mean, there is so much to talk about in the series because it tackles so many things which I think are pertinent to us and society at the moment. Human trafficking, sex slavery, online misogyny, as well as overt misogyny. It has a group of these internet dweebs who rate the sex workers they visit, and they sit around rating them, saying these things. They're being the most awful people, saying these most dreadful things online. The moment a waitress comes over, they shrink. They physically shrink. They're all very meek. And then the moment this waitress walks away, suddenly they're emboldened. These sort of alpha masculine males again. And I think that if anyone has only spent any time online recently, will probably be aware that this is something which is taking place.
Let's hear a little piece of season 2 of Top of the Lake.
A report from Bondi Beach. There's a suitcase washed up. There's black human hair coming from the inside.
You're with me.
Oh, darling, you want to tell me what you saw?
What is it about your cinnamon, mate? Come on, tell us.
Cinnamon worked at Silk 41.
Brothel.
My dad and my mum want to meet you.
The destiny of man
is to love a woman?
No, the destiny of man is to enslave women.
As you were saying, Toby, Elizabeth Moss really is owning the small screen at the moment. Matt, she's also really owned the stage as well. We know her perhaps currently for her starring role in The Handmaid's Tale, which everyone has been talking about. Give us a bit of an indication of how she's really owned some of her work on the stage, though, as well.
Well, she was on Broadway a couple of years ago in David Mamet's play Speed the Plough, in which she inherited a part originated by somebody readers or listeners will know by the name of Madonna. Elizabeth Moss did really well in a tricky David Mamet part, kind of undercharacterized, and you have to have a certain oomph that you just bring to the event because the part doesn't give you a whole lot. And she actually was on the West End stage some years back opposite Keira Knightley in a revival of Lillian Hellman's The Children's Hour, and she absolutely wiped the floor with Keira Knightley, I have to say. Really startling performance in an American period classic, which she should do again on Broadway because I think she'd get great reviews for it.
Sorry, I was going to say, I spoke when I interviewed her, I asked her about coming back, and she would very much
she
like
to. She seems to love the stage.
Yeah, she really would like to, but she's just had projects that have cropped up and have prevented her because of timings, etc., to doing that. But yeah, I mean, you know, normally when you say, oh, do you like to do staging? Of course.
Yeah.
But she was like, oh, yeah, I mean, absolutely.
I think she really does. Yeah. She really is a stage animal.
I really am so looking forward to that one. That is our Top of the Lake, China Girl. It's on every Tuesday on BBC Two if you're here in the United Kingdom. If you're in the US, you'll have to wait until September, I'm afraid, when it will be showing on the Sundance Channel and, of course, on Hulu as well. Now, over to Netflix now for one of their latest releases, Friends from College. In this, we meet a group of ex-Harvard friends fast approaching age 40 who are reunited when one couple moves back to New York. Affairs take place and there are heightened tensions as the gang desperately try to cling on to their friendships they had 20 years earlier. Let's hear a clip.
Last week, we were adults before we moved here. Turned 19 again.
It's a reunion! The friend group is back!
I know you love your college friends, but every time you get together with them, you all become a bunch of little bitches.
You remember Felix, my partner?
So loud.
We've got like 20 years of grievances built up. It all just gets so competitive.
Toby, there was a particularly high-profile filmmaker in recent days who was criticising the, I think you termed it as the mindless formula that Netflix uses for a lot of their original programming and certainly for a lot of the feature films they have on their lineup as well. I mean, it would be no secret to anyone who's a Netflix subscriber anywhere in the world that when you're scrolling through a lot of the films, a lot of them are geared towards mindless, fluffy, popcorn sort of fare. Not there's anything wrong with that whatsoever.
No, when it comes to Adam Sandler films, there's a lot wrong with that, isn't there?
There can be a lot wrong with that if you get in too deep. It would seem that this particular program from Netflix is perhaps following in that direction.
Friends from college, like you say, they're a group of friends from college. They're still buddies after 20 years. And we all have friends, I would think, you know, long-term friends. Friendships develop and move on, okay? Not these guys. They are stuck in this sort of mindset from 20 years ago. And so you sort of talk about the formula. What I think this is trying to do, and I say I think because it is pretty unbearable, is it tries to present a comedy where no one's likable and yet you're meant to give them your time. You're meant to somehow root for them or be intrigued or curious as to what they're doing and how their lives are going to progress. I mean, if you do find it intriguing enough to sit through it, I mean, well, congrats to you. And you're clearly not, you clearly might be related to some of the people who star in or worked on the production, because that's the only reason I can think that you would actually stick with it for such a long time. Mm. I mean, you Nicholas Stoller has created it and you wrote it, and you've got some couple of names you might mention: Keegan-Michael Key, Kobe Smulders, and Fred Savage, you know, late of The Wonder Years, of course, and I think Austin Powers 3, Gold Member, if I remember correctly.
Well done.
But so you have these group of friends. There is nothing about them that I care for, or there is nothing about them that wants me to, that makes me want to watch what happens to them, because they are quite dreadful as a set of people. And it's not funny. A rabbit gets killed in an incident when someone's trying to take a pet to the vet, but at the same time they're trying to continue this affair with this woman that they've been having an affair with since university. It's not funny. And what ends up happening is that they end up buying another rabbit. Oh, it's not the right type of rabbit. It's not the right species. So what does he do? He draws mascara around the rabbit's eyes to make it look as if it's actually the same species, because that species had dark rings around its eyes. I mean, hilarious, right? Rabbit death and whatnot. I think it's so fundamentally flawed in its attempts to present a group of people who you think, I kind of want to see them suffer. But just watching people suffer and you not liking them just is not enough.
It sounds like it's coming from that particular brand of American humour that we've seen for a little while now. I think Judd Apatow has a lot to answer for, but at least he does it with some success sometimes. Matt, this is appealing to a certain audience that wants to switch on something and turn their brain off. Are you the kind of person that ever just wants to turn your brain off?
Yeah, but I have to say, listening to that little excerpt, if that was a play, I would have sent it back for rewrite. Because, God, everything was sort of announced and telegraphed, and it just sounded totally uninteresting. And I am one of these people who has still a lot of friends from college. So the idea of it completely appeals to me, and how these friendships morph and evolve, fall away, get reinforced. But it sounds like this is just a wasted opportunity. I'm curious, Toby, how is Kobe Smulders? Because she was just on Broadway for the first time in a Noel Coward play, of all things, called Present Laughter. And she was really good doing Noel Coward. Who would have thought?
Kobe Smulders is good. I think one of the irritations of this is that you see people, particularly Fred Savage, who I, you know, have loved for many years, and you just think, oh, come on, guys, could you not have done something else? Like, was it just because it was Netflix and you said, okay, let's do it? I think it's there is a certain frustration with some of these people. You think they're better than this, but the fact that they are doing it is just so annoying.
It, I mean, that is just bizarre annoying. That Netflix was, for a long time, well, maybe it felt like a long time, that Netflix seemed to be this powerhouse studio that would produce lots and lots of shows, and you just knew that when it had the Netflix original logo, when it had that little intro with the boom boom at the start, you knew that this was going to be of a certain caliber. It almost seemed to be another AMC or HBO.
Yep.
And then there were just a few too many things that started to fall over, a few too many misfires. And look, we don't know how many people watch and how many people don't watch. We don't have any data like that. But it feels as though that Netflix original logo has been watered down quite a bit, doesn't it?
I think, obviously, as you expand the amount of productions, that is going to take place, of course. Now they're facing the same problem that any normal broadcaster would face, is consistency of quality. And it's all well and good having House of Cards there, if that's the one thing you've got. But then you expand it to another thing and another thing and another thing. And you have to look at Iron Fist, which was pretty awful, one of their Marvel shows. You look at say Netflix's comedy output. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt is just such a work of genius. Robert Carlock, Tina Fey, Ellie Kemper, Titus Burgess, Carol Kane, and it's gag, 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 gag. It's so brilliant. And this, you are waiting. It's a comedy, and you're waiting for the joke. Oh, was that? Oh, was I meant to laugh? Oh, was that meant to be? And it's over and over. And I have to say, sorry, I know we've got to crack on, but in the second episode, there is a scene set in a law firm with these alpha male types that is, I mean, so ludicrously full of testosterone. My screen pretty much grew testicles. I mean, it's over the top. It is so over the top. And even for a broad comedy, that would be too much. You kind of feel like if this was an idea given to someone else, other writers maybe, it might have had a little bit more warmth, a little bit of heart that you need to carry you through with dreadful people.
Well, I'm so glad I wasn't there to bear witness to that. that is Friends from College, which is on Netflix now. He's hoping that the next season of House of Cards can carry on the flame, though. I am certainly betting on that. Toby Earl, thank you for running us through those ones. Now we're going to turn to Matt Wolfe in just a moment to talk some theatre, but first, we've got to go book shopping in Amsterdam. Tucked away on one of the grand canals of the city is Pages, Amsterdam's only Arabic bookstore and the brainchild of Syrian publisher Sama El-Kadri. This is a place where you can find works by Egyptian writers in their original language, or even an Arabic version of children's Disney classic Frozen. It's also a space to celebrate Arab culture. Monocle's Amsterdam correspondent Venetia Rainey chats to owner Sama to find out more.
My name is Sama El-Kadri. I'm from Syria. My study is fine art. I'm a painter. I work in children books from 15 years. And before 2 years, we opened Pages Bookstore in Istanbul. And now here we are in Amsterdam in Pages Bookstore Cafe. We have everything: philosophy, history, study about religion, about the area, about Middle East, about revolution in these 7 years, novels, translated novels to Arabic from different language for famous names around the world. The bookstore, not just Arabic bookstore, we have English, Dutch, and Turkish. Sure, we will extend in Turkish and Dutch and English in these 2 weeks later. We opened before 1 month now, 12 June, we opened 1 month. What I see, yani, I can told you we calculated quickly, yani, how much people, they entered this place more than 1,500 person. And this is good. You cannot judge now in 5 weeks, it is short time. Yani, but in general, yes, they like it. Who's entrance here? They like at least the idea, at least the atmosphere, they like it. This is the important now. You can see some chairs, some things. You can find it in your home, for example, just to give you feel like home. We have a bar, small bar now, and it's free for people. Everybody can come, enjoy here, read book free, drink coffee, just enjoy. Literature or not always should about read books or something serious. For me, always there is fun. It should be fun. Sometimes listen just to music. Nobody read, for example, this person not read, but listen to music. This is culture. This is something good. Here we do music, life, cinema, theaters, exchange language, workshop for children, open mic, signing for authors. This is our slogan in Pages. It is your home. And because that, we try to make it like something people, when they enter, feel safe, I don't know, feel relaxed, feel like home. Yeah, I want this, because this place not for me, it is for the people and for artists, for they can do anything here, they can make any event here. Sure, it is very important with the immigration, for the Syrian, and all Arab, I think. If you want them, I have my opinion, if you want them to emigrate, very good, you should also create for them spaces like their home. This is help them to integrate, yes, and be relaxed with the new city and with the new community. But this place also not just for them, it is for all the nationality, all the people live in this city, in Amsterdam or in Netherlands. We try to bring all the culture together. We try to focus about this. Sure, we want also to present ourselves like Syrian, our culture, or Middle East culture for the world. Because also I saw in these 7 years how much the people, they don't know anything about us. And if you look, this is my dream really from a long time. When I travel a lot around Europe or in the world, always you can find English bookstores or American bookstores or French bookstores, but never you can find Arabic bookstore. And it is very less around the world. My plans, next city is Berlin. Yani this is my plan. Yani, and after that, New York. My dream to open it everywhere because it is good. Our culture is very, very important.
Thank you, Venetia Rainey, for that report. You are listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. I'm joined in the studio today by Toby Earle, who's just been talking television with us, and Matt Wolfe, who's going to tell us all about what we should and shouldn't be watching on the London stage this week. Matt, we should start now with the Apollo Theatre for a Tennessee Williams classic, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. This production is directed by Benedict Andrews. Now, I sadly have not been lucky enough to catch this story on the stage. I have seen the film version with Paul Newman and Elizabeth Taylor, which I understand is quite watered down from what you see on the stage, though.
Yeah, I mean, the movie, of course, is much admired because how could you not love those two stars? But it's largely emasculated and slightly eviscerated, which is interesting because emasculation and evisceration are two of the themes of Williams's play. And I think one of the reasons that this play in particular amongst the Williams canon keeps getting revived, and it seems to be, and I'm very happy about this, I love the play, it seems to be one of these plays that's almost always being done or about to be done somewhere in the UK, is because it does seem very kind of rough and raw and real. And this production ups the ante on all of those things. It's the first production of the play I've ever seen that has no interest in, for instance, the place where it's set. It's set famously on a vast southern plantation in America in the 1950s, ruled over by this mega wealthy patriarch called Big Daddy Pollitt, and he's a specter of kind of Trumpian proportions, but rather more articulate than my current American president, and sort of colliding within the vast mansion in which the play is set are all these disparate members of his family, particularly his damaged, sexually repressed, probably closeted son, Brick, and Brick's wife, Maggie, who is the cat on the hot tin roof of the title. And what the first thing that this production does rather extraordinarily, and this won't be to everyone's taste, but I liked it, I like metaphor, is that it brings the tin roof into the set. So the back wall of the set, designed by Magda Willey, who's a conceptual set designer who's worked with Benedict Andrews before, is this piece of gleaming metal, which is clearly a kind of, you know, would-be tin roof backdrop against which the characters can bounce their frustrations. It also becomes translucent at various moments, allowing for some very interesting kind of sensual imagery where you're kind of looking at the way the characters might want to be if they could only release their inner selves. So there's a lot going on in this production. It's not one for the purists, and I think it pays back. The other thing about it which really appealed to me is the Maggie of Sienna Miller. Now, here's an actress who's in her mid-30s now and who has spent a long time being everything but an actress. For a long time, she was, you know, famous for being the real-life consort of this or that A-list celebrity. She was kind of decorative. She was a model. She was an it girl. She was a party-goer. And you thought amidst all of this, okay, fine. Is she actually an actress? Can she act?
She was very much known, I think, for being a key symptom of that modern style of celebrity where you can actually remain famous without seeming to really do anything.
Exactly right. She seemed to have sort of fame by association. And I don't blame her for that. It's sort of the way these things go. And there is something about her as a figure, Sienna Miller this is, who strikes me as a survivor. She's somebody who can cling to it and keep at it. And that's exactly right for this part. You really feel, and the play is written in three acts. It's a very strangely structured play. And again, that's one of the things I love about it is its weirdness. The first act is basically a 50-minute monologue by Maggie, where she she's not talking to her husband, she's talking at her husband. And he kind of lurches about the stage with a busted ankle, and she parades her misery, her desperation, her sexuality, her this, her that. And it's very hard because you've got to shape it correctly. What a lot of actresses do is they just career through it as if to say, were I to stop at any minute, I would get off the speeding train. And actually, Sienna Miller is the first person I've seen since Kathleen Turner on Broadway many years ago who just takes it in its own rhythms and at its own time. And by the end, when she's talking about the martyrdom of Maggie and referring to herself as the cat on the hot tin roof, she's incredibly self-aware. You feel that she's earned every single moment of it. It's really bravura acting, and I hope it's acknowledged as such. She kind of disappears from the play after that for a long stretch. I guess Sienna can go and have a good lie down. And then the baton is passed to Jack O'Connell, playing Brick, the repressed husband, and his father, Big Daddy, played by Colm Meaney, the Irish actor, here doing a very good job as a kind of blustering patriarch. And interestingly, this is a role, I mean, it was originated by the great Burl Ives. Charles Durning did it wonderfully on Broadway. Ned Beatty did it previously on the West End. It's a role where you can absolutely go crazy. You can be belligerently larger than life. And what Colm Meaney, I assume, deliberately does is he pulls it back. He's quite real. The whole production seems quite real. And the long second act face-off between him and O'Connell is very, very well done. O'Connell is Brick, and of course a young film actor from Startup and Unbroken and many others, who has relatively limited stage experience, much less than Miller. Brick is a hard part because people are kind of talking at you, as I say, the whole time. First Maggie, then Big Daddy. And you only belatedly get a chance to respond. And listening on stage is one of the hardest things, I think, to do. And he does it very, very well. I should say, because this will probably titillate the tabloids, because everything Sienna Miller does titillates the tabloids. And in this production, it's made to order for the tabloids because there's a lot of bearing of flesh. At the very beginning of the production, Jack O'Connell is there in his altogether, except for the bit of him that's in a plaster cast. The rest of him is there on view. And during the play, he goes in and out of an onstage shower, which I think works actually very well metaphorically, because you keep feeling with this shower as if this character, who is so ashamed of his dubious past with the unseen skipper, is somehow trying to cleanse himself of whatever he did that might be construed as dirty. So there's that. But there's a moment of breast-bearing towards the end of the first act where Maggie is working her every wile to see if she can get Brick back into the fold, because, of course, their primary problem is that they don't have children. That is the big thing. She's infertile in a landscape where fecundity is everything. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but everyone will know it by the time they hear this. The very last sequence of the play, both of them are stripped bare. I mean, literally and figuratively. And that, I can guarantee you, has never happened before. Newman and Taylor didn't do it.
Certainly not.
Barbara
Paul
Bell
Newman
Geddes
did spend a lot of time in bed, though. With just
I think
a
there
sheet.
Are a lot of people who might have wished Paul Newman had done it, and Elizabeth Taylor as well. But I think, it works very well in this concept, because by that point in the play, these are both two characters who have nothing left to lose. So they might as well just show you as they are. And one of the questions that ricochets through the production is that Maggie keeps looking into a mirror. There are these two mirrors very pregnantly placed on the set. And she's always looking into them going, who am I? So it's as if by the end she's saying, here I am. Take it or leave it.
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is on at the Apollo Theatre until the 7th of October. Now to the Old Vic, where a new play by Connor McPherson is showing called Girl from the North Country. This one is based on a Bob Dylan song of the same name. Let's hear a little bit.
If you're travelling in the North Country fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there.
That was a part of the Bob Dylan song there. Now, we have seen various songs turned into stage productions of various different kind. This is a Bob Dylan song, so, you know, very much of the poetry realm of music. Matt, how does it work?
It's really its own thing. One of the great things about this production, which I liked a lot, is that you can't really compare it to anything else. I think what people assume it's going to be is exactly what it isn't. It isn't a jukebox musical. It uses a back catalog, but it isn't a back catalog musical. It's not really even a musical. It's a play, very much a play, by the Irish writer Conor McPherson, who also directed it, in which the music by Bob Dylan acts to amplify mood, provide atmosphere, italicize somebody's emotional state. Funnily enough, in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Benedict Andrews does much the same thing in that production, where he uses musical underscoring. Here, it's musical underscoring, except that the music is some of the best-known music of the 20th century. So you have songs like I Want You, Hurricane, Like a Rolling Stone, so on, sung by characters who, in Connor McPherson's narrative, are gathered together in a Duluth, Minnesota boarding house in 1934, Duluth, Minnesota being the town from which Bob Dylan hails, although the play is set before Bob Dylan was born. And boarding houses are great settings for things because they're like hotel lobbies or airports or restaurants. People come and go. So the good thing about a boarding house is you can have all of life's rich humanity on view. And in this, you have, you know, everyone from the kind of mentally aberrant wife who's got Alzheimer's and has been suffering all sorts of indignities, played brilliantly by Shirley Henderson from television's own Happy Valley, giving the most wonderful, wonderful stage performance. And I've been watching Shirley Henderson on stage for, God, 20 plus years, and I didn't know she could sing. And when she sings How Does It Feel, you know, from like Rolling Stone, it just pierces absolutely to the heart. I think if the play has a problem, it's that it really wouldn't work at all separated from the music, because it needs the music to punch it up, to give it a kind of juice. I'm not sure that the play on its own has enough muscle, whereas Cut on a Hot Tin Roof has plenty of muscle with or without the musical underscoring. But having said all that, it's a mesmerizing experience. And I think if you're in the zone, and it's the kind of play where you probably have to be in the zone, you might have a little mini epiphany while you're watching it.
Do you have to be a Bob Dylan fan to see this?
Not at all, Toby. And I'm not particularly, I mean, it's not that I dislike Bob Dylan. I like him a lot. But, you know, it's not somebody, he's not somebody that I kind of think about on a daily basis. But I did see many, many years ago, there was a pretty bad Broadway musical called The Times They Are Changin', which was the Bob Dylan back catalog.
Oh, wow.
Put into the service of a dance musical by the American choreographer Twyla Tharp.
Did you say dance musical?
I did say dance musical, Ben. I did. And I think it lasted a week or two, something like that. I saw one of its closing performances. And my guess, and this is just a surmise, is that Dylan's people have ever since then, and possibly before then, been looking for a way that he, their guy, Mr. Dylan, who's now, of course, a Nobel laureate, can have a show that honors the work and takes it someplace else. And if that's what they wanted, they've succeeded here. Because what it does is take the canon somewhere else and take the audience somewhere else. There's a fundamental, I think, sense of mystery to a lot of Dylan, something slightly out of reach. And that's exactly what this play is describing. But if you want a well-made play with a formal beginning, middle, and end, don't see this. But then if that's what you want, don't see Cat on a Hot Tin Roof either. They both kind of push theater in different directions.
Bob Dylan's people, famously protective of his image, they were not very happy with a film that was made some years ago called Factory Girl, which brings it all back to Sienna Miller. She played one of the starring roles in that.
Absolutely.
And forced the character of Bob Dylan to not be called Bob Dylan. I believe he was just referred to as the poet all the way through the script. Bit of a control F replace there. But that's Girl from the North Country. It's on at the Old Vic until the 7th of October. Matt, thank you very much for talking us through theatre today. Now, have you ever wandered around a contemporary art gallery and had the feeling that you have no idea what you're looking at and what it's all supposed to mean? Yes. Well, fear not, as a new book might just be the companion that you need. Who's Afraid of Contemporary Art? Another Elizabeth Taylor reference. There you go. Aims to demystify conceptual art so that it can be enjoyed by anyone, not just those with an art history degree, as authors Kyung Ahn and Jessica Karazi tell Monocle's Holly Fisher.
Jess and I have been thinking about this book for a long time. We've been working in the contemporary art field for a while now as a curator, writer. I, you know, trained in art history, working with artists. And whenever we tried to kind of explain what we were doing to our family and friends, they were quite baffled. And so we felt that there was a need for a simple, easy to read introduction to contemporary art and contemporary art world.
We really wanted to do something written in clear language, very direct, entertaining, and really demystify some of the art world and have you not feeling worried about sounding silly.
So if somebody came up to you and said, what is contemporary art? How would you try and sum that up in a sentence?
What you're seeing is contemporary art. That's what I would say. I think contemporary art is so difficult to define because that's like trying to define contemporary and art, two very broad terms. But, you know, in the simplest sense, it's art that's made today.
I think of it as any art being made by an artist alive today is contemporary art. The field of contemporary art is huge. I mean, I particularly take issue when somebody tells me they don't like contemporary art because I just think how can it encompasses so many things. And that's in a way why it's such a useful catch-all term. But I tend to think of it as a band of time that moves forward. So a band of time going backwards from the present day. And I think generally people tend to agree that this sort of breakpoint occurred in the 1960s with the emergence of performance and conceptual art and installation, that these practices are really relevant to today's contemporary art. Another one is, you know, often you'll look at something from the past and say, oh, it seems very contemporary because it's art that speaks to our time. So art that's really relevant to today's culture.
If people come to you and say, look, I don't really understand what this is about, can you introduce it to me in a way? Is there somewhere that you point people to? Is there a museum or an artist that you think, look, start with this and then ease your way into it?
Well, you should start with our book, Road to Contemporary Art. But yes, I think often the question we get asked, I mean, people would see a show and say, okay, I saw this and I didn't understand why they did that, or I don't understand why this is in a museum. And that's where you start. I think it's easy to ask people to look at artworks because it's right there. And there are usually wall labels and there's information on the artist. And, you know, you can kind of guide someone through an artwork. I think it's more difficult to guide someone through contemporary art as a field. But there's a lot of, you know, information out there and sources, and we can definitely, I mean, we point to the all the time, podcasts like this, you know, websites, museum sites. But I think the most important thing for me anyway is to actually go and see art rather than reading about it and thinking about it and talking about it. Actually go and see art, because I think that's what people forget in this Instagram world.
We should explain that it's not just about understanding contemporary art, but understanding how the whole industry works. Do you think that was important to you to explain, you know, what a curator does, what the art market is, what Art Basel is, things like that, to make people really understand?
Absolutely. I think this is something that we really wanted to address, because in a sense, from the outside, this is often how people experience contemporary art. You open the newspaper and you see, oh, it's Art Basel this week and it's been massively successful, or, oh, this work sold at auction and, you know, it's a record price. And so these are the questions that come up and the associations that people have with contemporary art. But actually, if you read a sort of primer of art history, it doesn't really fill you in on how that all fits together. So we really wanted to make a more comprehensive guide to art and the art world that shows you why it's structured the way it is, the experience that artists have, so that artists aren't just, you know, making art in isolation. They're making it working with a gallery. They're making it knowing that people are going to Instagram it potentially. There are all these factors involved, and when you look at an artwork, it is important to consider it within its environment, because that can give you a much deeper understanding of what the artist is looking to achieve.
So what do you think the art industry needs to do to make contemporary art a bit more inclusive for everybody?
So much. But I think each player has a role in achieving that, and we have to do it together. I can only speak for, you know, my field. I work in a museum as a curator. I'm an art historian. So, you know, what can I do there that can bring the audience closer to the art that we show, collect, explain? And I think, you know, you have to kind of start there. I think it's an effort on both parties, right? So, you know, the art world needs to make it easier for people to understand and find it approachable. But also, I think it'll be really great if people can give art a chance and jump in with confidence and a little bit of faith.
Who's Afraid of Contemporary Art by Kyung Ahn and Jessica Carrazzi is out now, published by Thames and Hudson. Now, we're nearing the end of today's program, but we couldn't finish things off without spinning the globe for this week's Global Countdown. As always, Fernando Augusto Pacheco has dropped into the studio. Fernando, where are you taking us?
Ben, today I decided to choose Uruguay.
Not
only because it's a very cool country in South America, you know, they're very liberal, and I think they're doing quite well, actually, economically, but we're to hear talk about music. And another thing, Ben, this year we're leaving the Latin American revolution in charts around the world, mainly because of the success of Despacito. But all those artists, guys, in the top five, if you look at the number of streams on YouTube, Spotify, it's huge numbers, and it's impressive.
Now, I've got a bit of a preview of the list. Sorry to spoil any of the fun, but I have to say, I do not recognize a lot of the names on this list. Are we looking at another one of those cases where a lot of the people appearing here are actually native talent?
Not, they are Latin American talent, but there's no one from Uruguay on that list.
That is a shame.
Even though my resource is saying that there are new up-and-coming Uruguayan artists, but they're not yet cracking the top five in their own country.
Okay, well, time will tell. Where shall we start on the list, though?
Let's start at number five. We have singer Chris Jade with Ahora Dice. He's from Puerto Rico, which is the same place as Luis Fonsi is from. And Puerto Rico is a machine of producing, of making great singers, actually, in the region, even though it's a very tiny country. But, you know, they're a bit like the Sweden of Europe, because, you know, they have a disproportionate number of talented musicians.
Well,
there.
Anyone who's watched RuPaul's Drag Race will know that they produce a lot of drag queens as well.
I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure of that. But it's an interesting, I think the north of Latin America, countries like Colombia, Puerto Rico as well, even perhaps Venezuela, they have a better music industry than perhaps the southern countries in some ways.
Well, at number four, we have someone by the name of Hey DJ.
Yeah, well, that's the name of the song, Hey DJ.
That's the name of the song.
It's by a boy band called CNCO.
CNCO. Oh, I'm not a huge fan of acronyms. All right, tell me, what does CNCO stand for? Do we know, or is it we're not meant to ask?
It's the first lyric of the names of the members of the band, which was created by, guess who? Simon Callow.
Really?
Yes. And the band was formed in Miami.
Okay.
And it is truly Latin America, because one of them is from Ecuador, the other is from Dominican Republic, one is from Puerto Rico itself, and the other one is from Cuba. Mm. And I have to say something about the song. You know, reggaeton is the main rhythm of Despacito, whatever, but this is called reggaeton lento, which is slow reggaeton. Mm. So it's kind of more romantic, more ballad-oriented.
Okay,
I prefer
that sounds
the first
all right.
one, but no problem.
Okay. All right. Move us up to number three on the list.
Let's sexy things up, because we have Maluma from Colombia. The song's called Felices Los Cuatro. And I mean, if you have a chance, it's a very, very sexy video clip and looks quite expensive. It looks like a very expensive R&B video from the 90s, in a way, which is not necessarily a bad thing ways.
No wonder you love it.
Yes. But yeah, it's and Maluma is one of the most famous as well singers in Latin America at the moment.
A good video clip can really make you look at a song quite differently, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly it changed the meaning of the song to me.
I'm not sure what he's alluding to there, but I don't think we'll ask.
Yeah.
All right. Number two.
Number two.
No relation to Frank, I assume.
No. I thought about that. Maybe he's a cousin of Frank Ocean, but it's Danny Ocean, and he's from Venezuela. And again, it's nice to see a Venezuelan artist, because the only time we hear about Venezuela these days is what's happening, the political situation of the country. But again, still quite a healthy music industry there. And this song has been a hit for months now and still remaining at number two. The song's called Me Rehuso. But we're here to talk about the number one song, right? I want to hear your opinion, guys, on it. Shall we listen to it?
Oh,
Ben?
Let's have a listen. Go on.
Yeah.
Freeze! Lo dice no miente, le gusta mi gente y eso se fue mundial. Freeze! No le bajamos, mas nunca paramos, es otro palo y blanco.
¿Y dónde está mi gente?
Me fue a bouger la tête.
¿Y dónde?
It sort of sounded like something went quite wrong in the middle there, didn't it?
It's in some ways, it's kind of hypnotizing. And I think that's
is that what you call it?
Yeah. No, I mean, perhaps in a bad way, hypnotizing, you know, because I wouldn't say it's my favorite song, but I can see the success of it. I mean, if you are on a dance floor with this repetitive beat, I mean, at some point you will have to dance to it.
Yeah, I think you can officially call that mind control, yes.
When they say freeze, is everyone dancing? Do they have to stop? They have to freeze. Is that like the?
I expect that would just come naturally, wouldn't
it? Yeah, that was a freeze. Hands up. I mean, what is that? Is that the dance move?
There is a little freeze. I can tell you that.
There is
a little freeze, which is more, you know, freeze and then. Uno, dos, tres, 1, 2, 3 in Spanish.
Well, that is the recipe for success right there on the South American charts, according
to Jay Boving, I should say his name. He's from Colombia as well.
Well, that's the number one in Uruguay.
The number one in Uruguay, and I must say, number one quite a few South American countries.
Quite a few countries in the region.
Yeah.
Well, that is good to know. What's the verdict on that for the studio? Matt, where are you at on this?
I loved it, and I can't wait for the old Vic to turn it into a show.
Freeze.
I just want to watch all these miniature mannequin challenges now taking place on the dance floor. Just people suddenly stopping dead still for a minute or so, or even less, seconds. It seems like a party tune.
It's a party tune.
Good summer party tune.
Yeah.
I think as Matt says, it's a stage musical in the making. The recipe is right there. All they need to do is listen. And that indeed brings us to the end of today's program. The show was produced by Holly Fisher and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Now to play us out, let's hear more of that number one track from J Balvin. Thank you for listening. Mi música no discrimina a nadie, así que vamos a romper. Toda mi gente se mueve, mira el ritmo como los tiene. Hago música que entretiene, el mundo nos quiere, me quiere a mí. Toda mi gente se mueve, mira el ritmo como los tiene. Hago música que entretiene, mi música los tiene fuerte bailando y se baila así.